The 1994 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 263, Charisma, Structure, and Contested Authority Within Mormonism by O. Kendall White, Jr. and Daryl White.
Mormon dissidents, the Manti Experience, another Waco. That has been moved to the Three Seasons Ballroom. Okay. Let's see. This paper will be given by the White brothers, Daryl and Kendall. They are originally from Salt Lake City, Utah. Let's see. Kendall White is a professor at Washington and Lee University. He received his bachelor's degree and master's degree in sociology at the University of Utah and a doctorate in sociology at Vanderbilt University. His brother, Daryl, also received his bachelor's degree at the University of Utah and his master's degree and doctorate at the University of Connecticut, and that was in anthropology. Both of them have published extensively in anthropological and sociological journals. Recently, the two have just finished editing a one-volume work on contemporary religion in the South. That will be printed by the University of Georgia Press and will be published this spring. Will be coming out this spring. I believe that Kendall will be giving this paper. He will talk for about 40 to 45 minutes, and then we will open up the remainder of the time, the remaining 10 to 15 minutes for questioning. Okay? And so at this time, we'll turn the time over to Kendall White.
I think I'll readjust this a little bit. Can you hear me? Okay. The title of our paper is Charisma, Structure, and Contested Authority Within Mormonism, and it's actually part of a project that we've been invited to participate in by the Association for the Sociology of Religion, which is looking at the way in which different religious traditions conceptualize the question of authenticity and truth. So we have been asked to contribute on the Mormon side of that. So this is a preliminary endeavor on our part for that project. Mormon history can be interpreted as a dynamic negotiation of democratic and authoritarian proclivities. Since Mormonism began with an explicit assumption that individuals were to enjoy direct religious experience, to have their own charismatic encounters, it created an internal dilemma the moment it sought to contain charismatic impulses within its emerging institutional structures. For a logical consequence of general access to charismatic religious experience is the presumption of an individual's ability and right to discern truth. A functional implication of the development of religious hierarchy, on the other hand, is the prerogative of ecclesiastical authorities to determine what is true. By institutionalizing the conflict between personal and institutional abilities and rights to discern truth, Mormonism has created various issues and produced several arenas in which authority and rights are often contested by church members and church leaders. This paper identifies several points where these conflicts arise and examines institutional procedures employed to contain charisma and control who may determine what is genuinely Mormon. We discuss revelation, bureaucratization, church conferences, canonization, certification processes, personal testimony, the use of history, and the significance of church courts. Revelation and hierarchy. Mormonism began with charismatic experience, the visions and revelations of Joseph Smith. Nurtured by this charismatic tradition, which emphasized direct contact with the sacred, the Latter-day Saints soon developed an ideology of revelation that to this day permeates their institutional structures, community forms, and cultural expressions. The development of Mormon conceptions of revelation provides an excellent example of the Routinization of charisma, a phenomenon identified by the German sociologist Max Weber, in which unique qualities of religious experience crystallize in social and cultural forms. In other words, religious movements channel and direct charisma toward the realization of institutional objectives. The meaning and use of revelation among Mormons provides ample evidence of the institutionalization of charisma, culminating in the organizational containment of charismatic impulses and the development of a charisma of office, where the status of church president, whomever the occupant, is sacralized as prophet, seer, and revelator. Early efforts to define appropriate forms of revelation and to determine to whom it may be granted were largely successful. And, though linked to organizational status, revelation remained available to everyone within limited boundaries. Revelation has been employed ideologically in both the past and the present to resist as well as facilitate change. And, at least for some prominent theologians, revelation was identified with reason and compatible with sensory experience. The earliest conceptions of both charismatic experience and the church in Mormonism, as Michael Quinn demonstrates, are quite different from currently held views. Before its legal incorporation on April 6, 1830, the official organization of the church, Joseph Smith and his associates participated in a non-structured community of believers, which they regarded as the Church of Christ. Charisma was diffuse and pervasive, and membership required only faith and repentance. No religious rites, including baptism, were necessary. In fact, as a summer 1828 revelation stipulated, quote, "My church," unquote, was simply the people, my people, or this people, bound to God and one another by consent and belief, without formal structure. Even repudiating organized religion as, quote, "they who do not fear me," quote, "neither keep my commandments," but, quote, "build up churches unto themselves," unquote, the revelation made no provision for priesthood, baptism, or other rites as prerequisites for membership. It simply asserted, quote, "Behold, this is my doctrine. Whosoever repenteth and cometh unto me, the same is my church," unquote. And underscoring the point, continued, quote, "Whosoever declareth more or less than this, the same is not of me, but is against me. Therefore, he is not of my church," unquote. The following year, in mid-1829, the church began to assume form and structure as the rite of baptism became a prerequisite for membership. Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer were to seek 12 disciples who would ordain priests and teachers to proclaim the gospel. Yet, as Quinn observes, these two loosely organized forms of ecclesiastical structure were profoundly egalitarian, with minimal, if any, ranking. Even references to apostles in the new church denoted charismatic claims rather than ordination to ecclesiastical office. With legal incorporation the following year, Smith's followers were formally organized into offices of elder, priest, teacher, deacon, and soon apostles under the name of the Church of Christ. While Joseph Smith was ordained first elder and Oliver Cowdery second elder, they had no special authority, but were, as Richard Bushman observes, first among equals. However, this would soon change. The meaning and nature of the church in early Mormonism had already experienced three transformations between the summer of 1828 and April 6, 1830, when it was legally incorporated. From one, my church as an intentionally unstructured community of my people, prohibiting religious rites as a test for membership and making no claims to priesthood authority, to 2, a loosely structured entity, a community of believers with limited offices, requiring baptism for membership, and calling themselves the Church of Christ, to 3, a clearly defined formal structure, thought to be the restoration of primitive Christianity, that would later evolve into the elaborate bureaucracy of modern Mormonism. In Mormonism's earliest form, charismatic gifts, including visions and revelation, were the privileges of everyone. The democratic manifestation appeared in the general access to revelation, prophecy, and spiritual gifts by other members of the community. Any limitations on charisma were as likely to fall on Joseph Smith as others. In fact, the March 1829 revelation, notwithstanding Smith as a recipient, limited his charismatic prerogatives to translation of the Book of Mormon. According to the text, the gifts associated with this task were the only prerogatives Smith was to assume. For the Lord declared that, quote, I have commanded him that he shall pretend to no other gift, for I will grant him no other gift, end of quote. This is, of course, not the way the revelation appears in contemporary versions of the Doctrine and Covenants, but if you pick up the Book of Commandments, this is the wording of the text that you'd see. This soon changed as Smith not only claimed additional charismatic prerogatives, but began to restrict the rights of others. The first challenges to Smith's privileged position regarding revelation came from Oliver Cowdery and Hiram Page. As second elder, Cowdery, who most likely regarded himself as Smith's equal, wrote to Smith in July 1830, contesting a point in the Articles and Covenants, the most significant revelation at that time on church governance. And Smith responded, asking Cowdery by what authority he commanded, quote, me to alter or erase, to add to or diminish from a revelation or commandment from Almighty God, end of quote. Visiting Cowdery and the Whitmer family, Smith, with some effort, convinced them that the dispense, quote, was in accordance with the rest of the commandments, unquote, thereby averting a serious threat to his leadership. Page's was a more serious challenge. By producing revelations through the use of a sacred stone, which influential Mormons like Cowdery and the Whitmers were reading, Page became a potential rival for Mormon leadership. Smith produced a revelation stating that, quote, no one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church except my servant Joseph Smith Jr., unquote, and, quote, those things which he, Page, hath written from the stone are not of me, and that Satan deceiveth him, unquote. However, it was Smith's artful control of a church conference in which he argued that Page's revelations did not comport with the order of God's house that successfully transformed the issue into a constitutional matter. Who really had authority to pronounce revelation for the church? Having Cowdery read the Articles and Covenants to the conference, Smith then demonstrated that the procedures and leadership structure specified therein precluded erratic claims to revelation and authority. Smith was sufficiently convincing to be appointed by voice of the conference, to, quote, receive and write revelations and commandments for the church, unquote. That's a quote from Richard Bushman. Having established his authority as head of the church, Smith was the seer, translator, prophet, and apostle. Only he could receive commandments and revelations for the church, and only he could inscribe scripture. Mormonism would institutionalize this resolution of the conflict in a charismatic office of prophet, seer, and revelator to be the sole prerogative of presidents of the Mormon Church. With organizational expansion, a hierarchical principle limiting revelation contained charisma within specific institutional boundaries. Thus, individuals could receive revelations within the domains of their official positions, but not beyond them. And the authenticity of such revelations would be established by their consistency with known church doctrine and policy. Revelations challenging or contradicting official doctrine or practice were by definition inauthentic. They were of Satan. Revelations purporting to extend beyond the sphere of authority of an individual were also by definition inauthentic. They too must be rejected out of hand. So a bishop might anticipate revelation to assist him in governing his ward. He could expect none with implications either for those above him in the hierarchy or those in the same horizontal relationship but outside his ward. Nor could his revelation challenge existing doctrine and practice. Consequently, when Douglas Wallace, a Mormon bishop in Washington, ordained a black male to the priesthood in 1976, Mormons throughout the world knew instantly that the ordination was illegitimate. Wallace had overstepped his bounds and abused his authority. Even those sympathetic with his protest anticipated, in some cases perhaps even welcomed, the disciplinary action resulting in his excommunication. Wallace had violated a fundamental principle of Mormon social organization. This hierarchical delimitation of revelation defines both the appropriate sphere of influence and the legitimate content of revelation from the president of the church downward to the family, the basic social unit, with the father as head of the household, and finally to personal revelation for individual guidance. The latter can have no implications for anyone other than the individual recipient. I'm going to skip a section here in which we discuss the relationship between revelation and religion, revelation and reason, in which we argue that Mormon conception of revelation is fundamentally rational. But we don't have time for that. The ideological use of revelation in Mormon experience also illustrates this rationality. Rejecting the idea that the scriptural canon was closed with the New Testament, Mormonism boldly proclaimed its own legitimacy in terms of continuing revelation. Not only was the gospel restored through a number of divine disclosures, but the church's encounter with novel, historical, and social conditions requires new revelation. Consequently, changes in institutional policy, for example, both the introduction and abandonment of polygamy and the admission of black males to the priesthood in 1978, were justified and implemented, legitimated, by the principle of continuing revelation. Since revelation is contingent upon human effort as well as the appropriate social conditions, church officials use revelation to both resist and facilitate change. Those who would have eliminated the policy prohibiting blacks from holding the priesthood, or those who would abandon the current practice of withholding it from women, encounter a deeply entrenched belief asserting that such changes are only possible with new revelation. However, when the president announces a new revelation that alters church policy, as occurred with the 1978 decision admitting black males into the priesthood, there is little dissent and virtually no effort to insist on the previous practice. While this means that the church changes slowly, it also suggests that when change does occur, there will be very little resistance. This is both a function of the belief in continuing revelation and the principle of hierarchical delimitation. But it also follows from the institutional requirement for consensus in the governing bodies of the church. Revelation requires church councils to govern by consensus rather than majority rule. so it often takes some time for church leaders to create the actual or fictive agreement needed for action. Once census is realized, however, there's no basis for a church official to lead a resistance movement that might galvanize factions within the Mormon community. Consequently, the church can implement change with remarkable ease and little resistance. At the same time, its doctrine of continuing revelation often functions to protect institutional practices, preserve ideological interest, and resist change. As we saw above, Joseph Smith effectively used an early church conference to establish his position as prophet, seer, and revelator. And we'll say a few things about general conference as a form of determining authenticity here. The general conference, a technique Bushman implies Smith may have borrowed from the Methodist, initially occurred whenever perceived necessary. Originally used for decision-making, to adjudicate conflicts, establish the scriptural canon, announce new doctrine, legitimate authority, and discipline dissenters, the General Conference was institutionalized in its semi-annual format after 1840. It functions today as a means of celebrating institutional achievements. It reinforces authority, preserves unity, and marginalizes those whom officials do not want emulated. The authoritarian nature of contemporary conferences, with no discussion, debate, or decision-making, reinforces this propensity for church authorities to label and thereby marginalize those whom they want excluded from the Mormon community. Today, decisions may be announced and policies proclaimed, but neither is made nor determined at a general conference. A perfunctory raising of the right hand for the unanimous sustaining of church leadership or the acceptance of a new item in the official canon, which is quite rare, is the only active role for church members, for they are there to hear, not be heard. Even general authorities are tightly controlled. Those addressing conferences no longer speak as the Spirit dictates, but must have prior approval from the appropriate committee for their remarks. Sometimes the text of a conference address will be altered in the editorial process as it's prepared for publication and distribution. We have a nice example of that described by Lavina Fielding Anderson, who used to work as assistant editor at Ensign magazine. And I'll read here her description of what they did then with conference talks. Assignments for conference talks were made several weeks in advance of conference, and the finished texts were ready at least 2 weeks in advance. Before the first session began, the editors had checked all the quotations, done what usually very light editing was required, consulted with the authors about the problems or questions that had emerged during the editing process, and typeset the talks. At the same time, translators were preparing delivery text in their target languages for simultaneous translation. During delivery, we followed each talk as broadcast on television, word for word, making note of even the minutest of changes, and replaying the simultaneously produced audio tape versions to transcribe last-minute departures or of more than a word or two. That's the end of the quote. Today, General Conference is used to enhance conformity and maintain control over both belief and behavior. No longer a decision-making mechanism, nor a means of adjudicating conflict, conference remains a vehicle for instructing the saints and has assumed a central role in the autocratic proclamation of new policy and the stigmatization of individuals and groups threatening the hegemony of church officials. More recently, the conference pulpit has been used to deny legitimacy, to define as outside the Mormon community intellectuals, feminists, and gay and lesbian Mormons. By discrediting those so identified, church officials hope to retain the primary role in defining who is authentically Mormon. Turn now to canonization. Consistent with its early role in decision-making process, General Conference was important for establishing the Mormon canon as well as the process of canonization. Moreover, the canonization process, like the fate of organizational decision-making, follows a parallel path of centralization with canonical decisions made by top councils and committees. These are presented to church members via General Conference, with the perfunctory sustaining vote guaranteed. Notwithstanding the claim of a Mormon scholar that the highest quorum in LDS church government is the general membership, no significant decision is made at conference, nor by any body comprised of the general membership. Empirically, this presumption of a democratic polity is void of evidence. Even before the end of the 19th century, the ecclesiastical polity had sufficiently crystallized to ensure that institutional decision-making, church policies, and canonization procedures were firmly under the control of the Council of Twelve and the First Presidency. Procedures granting final approval of the official canon to the general membership had become hollow ritual. We describe the development of the Mormon canon, scriptural canon, including, of course, the Bible, the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and Pearl of Great Price. We'll basically skip that discussion at the moment, move on to some other issues with canonization. The most recent scriptural canonization occurred in 1979 with the creation of a new LDS edition of the King James Version of the Bible, and the early 80s when this Bible became available in a single volume with the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and Pearl of Great Price as the standard works of the church. The Bible contain new chapter headings, a 600-page topical index, an intricate cross-referencing system, and a dictionary. While the cross-references integrated the Bible into unique Mormon scriptures, the chapter headings, topical index, and dictionary combined the former to present biblical materials in a distinctively modern Mormon framework. Designed to correct errors, improve doctrinal scholarship, integrate Joseph Smith's inspired version of the Bible with the King James Version, and establish the scriptures as the anchor, the central focus of the contemporary church, this project organizes the entire scriptural corpus in terms of contemporary theology. Instead of using scriptural texts to derive doctrine, it uses current doctrine to interpret scriptural texts. Topical headings for biblical chapters, for example, appear in terms of contemporary doctrine rather than being derived from the text itself. Consequently, ancient texts are read as if the authors intended the distinctive meanings of LDS theology today. Though the circularity inherent in this process may be evident to others, for believers it's a powerful form of legitimation. They see their own beliefs affirmed in ancient text. Since typical readers will not know that the presentation of the text itself provides the conceptual framework for its own interpretation, they will simply assume that contemporary doctrines derive from revelation found in ancient text. This whole apparatus, with its topical arrangements, cross-references, and dictionaries, imposes the conceptual framework of the most conservative contemporary Mormon officials on the scriptural canon. Church leaders justify contemporary doctrines and practices by a scriptural foundation, which in fact is their own reconstruction of the ancient past. As the saints participate in an unreflective study of these new scriptures, they're unlikely to recognize the circularity inherent in their assertions of scriptural authenticity for current doctrine. The new canon will soon be, if it's not already been, institutionalized as a taken-for-granted aspect of Mormon religious experience. Not actually part of the scriptural canon, statements issued by the Mormon presidency, to which they affix their signatures, have an official status as declarations of institutional policy and doctrinal clarification. They typically appear when church officials suspect that the Latter-day Saints are too accepting of social changes or are becoming increasingly confused about doctrinal matters. As Latter-day Saints became more critical of the church's racial policy following World War II, the First Presidency periodically issued statements declaring that the priesthood prohibition was based on revelation and that it would require revelation to be changed. More recently, the Mormon presidency used this vehicle to discourage church members from participating in such symposia as this. The most recent use of the official statement by the First Presidency following the April 1994 General Conference urges the saints to join political efforts designed to prevent legalization of gay and lesbian marriages. A mechanism for mobilizing political action, statements of the First Presidency also delineate the boundaries one must not cross to remain a good Latter-day Saint. In a brilliant analysis of Mormon canonization, Jan Shipps argues that the church's active manipulation of its own history should be recognized as a means of developing an unofficial canon through the creation of official history. Using Brigham Young's suppression of the history of the Smith family by Lucy Mack Smith, the prophet's mother, Shipps demonstrates how the text portrays early Mormon experience in terms of the Smith family, not simply Joseph, thus adding credence to the claims that a descendant of Joseph Smith should be his legitimate heir, potentially lending support to Young's rivals, who years later would coalesce to form the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mother Smith's autobiography at least implicitly undermined the legitimacy of the succession claims of Brigham Young. Acknowledging that it was 1845, not 1984, Shipps nonetheless suggests that Young may well have anticipated George Orwell, with the latter's recognition that, quote, "He who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past." More recent examples, the fate of Allen and Leonard's The Story of the Latter-day Saints and Arrington's tenure as church historian, show that contemporary Mormon leaders are no less interested in control over the presentation of the Mormon past than was Brigham Young. Reacting to the new Mormon history, which grants too much credence to economic, political, social, and cultural factors for explanations of the Mormon phenomenon, top ecclesiastical officials, including Ezra Taft Benson and Boyd K. Packer, demanded histories that presented events in faith-promoting terms. The story of the Latter-day Saints would not become a text for seminary, institute, and BYU students. The 16-volume history project envisioned by Arrington would have to be abandoned. Envisioned by Arrington would not be sponsored by the church, and authors would either have to abandon projects or find their own publishers. Leonard Arrington would receive a new title, be removed from the church office building, and relocated at Brigham Young University. The new Mormon history would become grist for the mill of scholars, but church officials would simply dismiss any history failing to place God squarely at the helm. We now deal with worthiness interviews and the certification process. Though anthropologists Mark Leone and Janet Dolgen seriously underestimate the authoritarianism inherent in Mormon social organization, as well as its impact on the regulation of belief and behavior, both correctly argue that Mormons tend to define themselves in behavioral terms, since the authoritarian hierarchy, from their perspective, is an illusion, merely facade disguising genuine individuality and a diverse belief system. Mormons preserve their identity and maintain their community through behavioral markers. Consequently, Mormon dietary practices, sexual norms, participation in church activities, attendance at the temple, and loyalty to church authorities are the real signifiers of an individual's identification with Mormonism. These behaviors suggest to both the individual and others that this person is an active Mormon, a good Latter-day Saint. Both Mormons and perceptive non-Mormons recognize good Mormons by these behavioral markers. If Leone and Dolgen accurately identify the significance of behavior for delineating boundaries between Mormons and non-Mormons, Gentiles, good and bad Mormons, they seriously underestimate the hierarchical control over behavior which follows from Mormonism's unique integration of behavior and belief. Crystallization of such behavioral markers as criteria determining an individual's worthiness for full participation in the church, if not the community, entails extensive control on the part of the church. We go on to some discussion of worthiness interviews and the process, obviously, of certification for the temple, advancement in the priesthood, and so on. What I'm going to do, though, is simply omit that for the moment and deal with two items that are of particular importance for us: the sustaining of church officials and the requirement for personal testimony. If these are behavioral markers indicating who is a good Mormon, they are critical links. They are also critical links between the individual and the institution. Both are means of ensuring institutional loyalty and maintaining social control. The question of whether one sustains the authorities asked during worthiness interviews requires a confession of subordination to church leadership. In practice, it privileges the judgments of church officials over one's own. It grants to officials the right to decide religious matters. When individuals are summoned before church courts for expressing controversial ideas or political dissent, they are typically charged with failure to sustain church authorities, and failure to sustain church authorities can be costly. I won't go on with the description of the cost that I suspect all of us are aware. If sustaining church authorities is a mechanism of institutional control, then a Mormon testimony may be considered a means of cognitive control. As revelation or inspiration, theoretically, a personal testimony is the embodiment of charisma, the very antithesis of institutionalization. As a direct experience of the sacred, it knows no authority beyond itself. While such charisma may lead to excessive individualism, its social manifestation is often the foundation of religious democracy, wherein authority derives from the individual and his or her experience. On the surface, the principle of sustaining church officials and policies also reflects this democratic impulse with the requirement of consent from the governed. However, the Mormon testimony has been domesticated. It appears in predictable linguistic form with bounded content. It is a performance ritual, tying the individual's experience into the community's origin myth. It has been thoroughly institutionalized as an affirmation of basic Mormon assumptions and governing principles. The personal testimony links the self to the institution by locating the individual within the institutional structure. Proclaiming that one knows that God exists, that Jesus is the Christ, that Joseph Smith was the prophet through whom the gospel was restored, that the current president of the church is the prophet, seer, and revelator who governs with 12 apostles called by God, is a personal, though typically public, confession of one's subordination to church hierarchy. By bearing this testimony, individuals place themselves in a precarious position. They privilege the judgment of church officials over their own, and their testimony could come back to haunt them should they confront church authority. While a good Mormon is to have a personal testimony, a personal testimony is only authentic when it conforms to a highly institutionalized ritual pattern. Personal testimony is void of this content and structure, like those of Christian fundamentalists, are not Mormon testimonies, and the faithful easily recognize them as foreign. The Mormon testimony is contained charisma, which legitimates contemporary doctrinal and institutional forms. We go on with the consideration of development of bureaucracy and history of the correlation program, which I'll not describe for the sake of time. Simply let me indicate that what we do is look at the centralization of power that occurs with that, the standardization of curricula, the virtual elimination of any kind of theological diversity in manuals or official church publications, the loss of control by those who head church auxiliaries, especially, let's say, the Relief Society, which has the implications then of a reduction, at least officially and formally, in the power of women within the church. And we focus on the management style that the correlation program then produces. Now, one might say then is that an implication of this, let me in fact just state an implication of this. This concentration of power among increasingly homogeneous conservative general authorities portends, at least for the immediate future, even a more restrictive definition of authenticity within Mormonism, including the creation of a narrow orthodoxy perpetuated through bureaucratic measures. Turn briefly to the intellectual subculture as a response to that. As the correlation program was concentrating power, standardizing programs, simplifying ideas, and limiting charismatic expression, Mormons were becoming better educated and more sophisticated in their understanding of religion. Lacking adequate outlets for expressing their intellectual and religious energies, they've created new subcultures catering to a number of interests. We'll confine brief comments to an intellectual subculture, though the latter might have developed within an institutional framework, as the 1930s seemed to pretend. The growing conservatism of the church in the post-World War II era culminated in the correlation program. This fostered a split between the institutional church and the Mormon community. Today, the two are not coterminous. The Mormon intellectual community, which has even expanded considerably since mine and Daryl's youth, now includes a wide range of unofficial organizations that sponsor cultural and intellectual life, and we'll skip the discussion of Dialogue, Sunstone, Journal of Mormon History, all of those indicators of this kind of vibrant intellectual subculture. And turn then to recent attempts to by Mormon officials to intimidate intellectuals. Okay, these recent attempts by Mormon officials to intimidate intellectuals appear to be part of a concerted effort to reestablish the church's hegemony over the Mormon community. While an ensuing confrontation between church authorities and Mormon intellectuals is likely to cause considerable personal suffering and institutional embarrassment, as illustrated by recent events, it's too late for church authorities to regain control over Mormon intellectual life. Nor can they limit the boundaries of the Mormon community to the Mormon church. Mormon intellectuals simply enjoy too much autonomy and are too well organized. Yet this has become the arena for contested authority. Intellectuals insisting on the right to examine Mormonism, church authorities asserting their prerogatives as institutional guardians. Both insist that they embody the essence of the Mormon spirit, both claim to be the authentic manifestation of Mormonism. And this results then obviously in the invoking of church courts, the last item here. Escalation of the conflict has reached the point that church officials employ their ultimate sanction, the ecclesiastical court, to contain intellectual challenges. Established to, one, save the souls of transgressors, two, protect the innocent, and three, safeguard the purity and integrity and good name of the church, a disciplinary council typically composed of the bishop and his counselors, where the stake president and the high council determines the guilt or innocence of the accused. Now, they could, of course, exonerate someone, or they have as sanctions formal probation, disfellowshipment, or excommunication. Typically, the charge dealing with intellectuals is the question of apostasy. Apostasy is the typical charge, then, brought against intellectuals. Though applied quite loosely, it encompasses public opposition to the church or its leaders, teaching as church doctrine information that is not church doctrine, and following the teachings of apostate cults. Usually, intellectuals excommunicated for apostasy are formally charged with failure to sustain church officials, teaching false doctrine, and holding the church up to public ridicule and embarrassment. Following last year's Sunstone Symposium, the highly publicized trials of six intellectuals disciplined for their speeches and writings have polarized the Mormon community. Undoubtedly, church leaders have succeeded in marginalizing intellectuals. Many of the faithful would never think of attending a Sunstone Symposium. Such Latter-day Saints will be even more suspicious of scholars whom they now regard as apostates who have no authentic claim to being Mormon. On the other hand, the action of church officials has own legitimacy in the eyes of those Latter-day Saints who believe their religion is rational and deserving of serious literary and scholarly attention. To many of these Mormons, ecclesiastical officials have abused their authority, discrediting themselves and the church. One thing is certain. The recent use of ecclesiastical sanctions, including church courts, has not successfully contained challenges to authority. In fact, it may have intensified them. Exactly who may claim the right to Mormonism is once again highly contested. However, at this juncture, with the negotiation of new boundaries between the institutional church and the Mormon community, the contest is partly over whether the institution or the community has the right to define what is authentically Mormon. Listen to Levi Peterson speaking from this forum last year as he reminds us that the ultimate institutional sanction, excommunication, is not sufficient to define someone as outside Mormonism. Quote, "Finally, if your particular identity and indignation demand a course of action that seems fated to lead to excommunication, well, God bless you and give you courage. Even here, I have some advice, which is that excommunication is no reason for withdrawing from Mormonism. I fancy that if I were excommunicated by a church court on a weekday, I'd be back sleeping in sacrament meeting on the following Sunday. Presumably, I'd be relieved of my duties as home teacher and occasional instructor of the high priest group. Presumably, I'd not be called on to pray or preach, but those are petty losses. I'd continue to partake of the sacrament unless I was expressly forbidden to do so. And even in that case, I'd attend meetings from time to time in a ward where I wasn't known, and I'd partake of the sacrament there. Though, as a corporation, the church may be owned by its legally constituted officers, as a moral community, Mormonism is beyond ownership. You and I belong if we choose to belong. I, for one, choose to belong. I'll not let another human being, however highly placed, drive me from Mormonism. End of quote and end of paper.
I failed to mention that Tom Karen of the University of Utah will not be here due to an unspecified accident. So we do have time for questions. As you know, just please direct your questions up here at the front and speak in the microphone. I'd like to start, though. I just have one question for either of you. You kind of alluded to the fact that perhaps modern revelation as we know it today comes in the form of a first presidency statement. And can you distinguish that from what's in the canon or regular conference talks? Can you make distinctions between those different forms of revelation?
I guess we should be back up there. Do you want to answer that? One of the things that we had omitted in the section on revelation and reason is the kind of argument. It's not okay. Is the kind of argument that was developed by B.H. Roberts, James Talmadge, and John Witzel, where their answer to your question, for instance, would have been that revelation in Mormon experience being rational is something that can't simply be identified with a narrow scriptural canon, with simply the let's say pronouncements of the first presidency, but would have to be recognized in the discovery and disclosure of nature as well. I don't know exactly in terms of your question where, if you're asking what would be a kind of official judgment about the status of the scriptural canon versus the pronouncements of contemporary church leaders, we would have obviously some kind of debate within Mormonism. Recent statements where some authorities have said that the words of the existing prophet take precedent over those of former prophets or of the scriptural canon would suggest that one answer to that question, at least, is simply depends on who's president of the Mormon Church. But I think the general, more typical Mormon position would be that the scriptural canon, which does include modern revelation, is the solid basis for revelation claims.
As a label to identify only, in the Sterling McMurrin sense, your interpretation of what the gospel should be all about, from the position that you have as your professorship at the institution you have, is the same type of pressure exerted on you, Kendall, as the famous September 6 here in the Valley?
No, I think neither Daryl and I have anything like that kind of pressure. I think not, but that might be partly that Daryl and I are inactive. And I really think that the last move was an attempt to make it clear to members of the church that even though there are a lot of active Mormons who are active intellectuals, these are folks you got to watch out for. I think those of us who are already inactive probably doesn't require that judgment. But so we've experienced certainly no kind of pressure from ecclesiastical officials within our area. And in both cases, where Daryl is at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, I'm at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, Mormons are fairly esoteric subject matter that probably produces a bit more curiosity than it does any kind of adverse reaction. So we probably, in fact, are even sort of rewarded for the things we've been doing. I don't know whether Daryl wants to add anything to that or subtract.
It sounds like you're saying that the September 6 were targeted as much because of their activity in the church as anything else.
That I don't know whether Daryl shares that judgment fully, but okay. Yeah, I would say that. I think that historically the use of excommunication with respect to intellectuals has had different audiences that the authorities wanted to send the message to. My own hypothesis here would be that when they want to send the message to Mormon scholars, who are active Mormon scholars, but that's a narrow community or group, they have often selected somebody who could be excommunicated, who didn't care whether he or she was excommunicated, who was qualified as a Mormon scholar but was marginal enough to the community, that the message that scholars got is that it's kind of dangerous to play around with these things. And so that might be clearly somebody who was inactive. I'd say Daryl and I would be more of a target in that context if the audience were to be other Mormon scholars who were writing about Mormonism. What I think the church is concerned about now is the impact of something like Sunstone and the visibility of it, the publicity of it, and the fact that many of the people whom they zeroed in on, people who lived in those wards, would have recommended them or recognized them as the very embodiment of the best of Mormonism. And so they're making the line clear, I think, to general membership rather than to scholars at this point. That's conjecture, but it seems to me to be the pattern that had existed.
I was doing some private research on the birth control issue and was reading in Encyclopedia of Mormonism, Church Policy, and came across the article that referred to the Handbook for Leaders as the authoritative statement from the church. Yet when I went to Deseret Book, I was told I couldn't buy the Handbook for Leaders. And so I was unable to pursue my own research into what the church actually teaches on a topic of interest. I was wondering if you have run into any other churches or organizations such as Mormons where the membership is actually prevented from getting the most authoritative information available.
Let me do two things in answering your question. One would be that if you want to talk for a minute afterwards, I have the General Handbook of Instruction. Would be happy to provide you with the information you're interested in. So that's the first point. And you're quite right, that isn't available to general membership. That's available essentially to bishops and to authorities. I don't know, because in a sense what's happened there in the case that you're talking about is a reference to a document that is used by ecclesiastical officials. There are probably comparable kinds of documents in other churches where there are manuals that are not part of the general consumption. Whether they're guarded in the way that these tend to be, I suspect probably not so much. But I think one could find other authoritative sources, let's say. In fact, Mormon population would have to find other authoritative sources to know the meaning of the church's position on abortion, birth control, anything else. And usually these are found in formal statements that had been made by the First Presidency. I remember Tom O'Day years ago in his book writing about Mormons not believing in birth control, though they practiced it. The time I read that, I wondered how well, but that's another matter.
The statements seem to be somewhat different than pronouncements by prophets.
But I would be happy to provide that for you.
We have time for one more question, so fight it out.
In your the topic, charisma is referenced. If you were to rank the Church on Charisma between 0 and 10, where would you rank it? And is that a cause for the conflict? And if you find charisma still in the church, where do you find it? Is it within the general authorities? Is it within the remote areas of the church? Or is it within the intellectual community?
Well, I think one answer, if you mean charisma that hasn't been institutionalized, I use that term is derived from the work of Max Weber and refers to an experience that's inherently, in a sense, anti-institutional. It's religious experience, as we'd think of it. And you could say that it is institutionalized, certainly among the general authorities. And that's what I meant by that routinization of charisma, as it appears in scriptural text. One would refer to that as institutionalized, but nonetheless charismatic. It's probably more open or less bounded, if you will, not simply in the intellectual community, because it can often be quite uncharismatic. It's more analytical. But it might be in Mormon subcultures, Mormon communities, Mormonism at more of a folk level, I think. And I don't know quite how to pronounce on the status of it among general authorities. We've had, I think, within Mormonism, some prophets who, let's say, have benefited from the charisma of office. Others have had somewhat more personal charisma that was also manifest in their experience. My guess is that people would tend to see Spencer Kimball more charismatic as an individual, and see some of his predecessors and successors as reaping the benefits of a charisma of office. Does that answer your question? Sort of.
Thanks. The next session will start in 10 minutes, I believe.
And thanks for joining us again here on live on KCPW 88.3 FM. Excuse me. We're coming to you live from the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, and that's being held at the Salt Lake Hilton Hotel, located at 150 West on 500 South in Salt Lake City. Feel free to join us here if you are in the local area. We've just been listening to a session discussing charisma, structure, and contested authority within Mormonism, a paper presented by O. Kendall White, Jr. and his brother, also a sociologist. Both of them teach sociology at university level, his brother Darrell White. The paper consisted of an examination of the conflict between democracy and authoritarianism in the Mormon experience. And the what would seem as a central paradox to some of the Mormon theology, which is that on the one hand, a personal testimony is a required way of stating a person's faith, and on the other hand, church authorities are considered the ultimate authorities in defining what doctrine is, despite the fact that what Mormons term personal revelation is often thought to be at least discussed in a higher entity. We will be bringing you another session in just about 10 minutes or so. Just a reminder that all tapes that you, all the sessions you've been listening to on the broadcast are available on tape. And you can call 532-3344 at the Salt Lake Hilton and ask for the Sunstone Desk. And we can tell you which tapes are available. We can let you know about other sessions that will be broadcast during the remainder of today and during the course of tomorrow. And we can also let you know about other sessions that are happening that will not be broadcast. There are generally about 6 sessions during each hour, and they cover topics as diverse as Mormon art and the assimilation of Mormonism into the general culture of America, and there are sessions dealing with LDS humanitarian efforts. The session that we'll be hearing in the next hour deals with child sexual abuse in the LDS community, and the authors of the the panelists will address the question, is the leadership of the LDS Church responding appropriately to problems that have occurred within the LDS community regarding child sexual abuse? So join us for that session in just about 7 minutes or so. Until then, we'll return you to the studios of KCPW.